Israel is doing in Gaza, you can't deport a foreign national for protesting what Israel is doing in Gaza. And yet that is exactly what the Trump administration is trying to do. And it's employing a little used provision of the Immigration Act, which was designed to essentially give the Secretary of State the ability to remove or keep out high-level people, officials, whose entry would in some way undermine our foreign policy by sending the wrong message. We approve of this group by allowing its leader into the country. That policy, which gives the Secretary of State the ability to remove people whose presence or activities here poses serious foreign policy consequences, has very rarely been used, and only for high officials. And now the Trump administration is using it for ordinary students on college campuses who are doing nothing more than engaging in protests. The idea that a protest on a college campus poses serious adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States is ludicrous. We are stronger than that. We can tolerate the fact that people among us disagree about Israel and Gaza. In fact, we must tolerate that under the First Amendment. But the administration is not tolerating that with respect to foreign nationals, seeking to chill protest, and I think succeeding thus far, because everyone is deathly afraid that they're going to get picked up if they do no more than, you know, advocate for the human rights of people in Gaza. It's a travesty.
And David, I wanted to ask you also about the assault on universities by the federal government, the withdrawal of funds, the pressure by some conservative members of Congress to remove university presidents, and even the federal government, for instance, in the case of Columbia University, demanding that the university remove the head of a department of Middle Eastern studies. Regardless of whether this is legal or not, the impact that this is having on the functioning of these universities and the fear that it's instilling across the country to university administrations.
Yeah, no, this is all part of the scheme, right? I mean, again, what is Trump doing? He's targeting the most vulnerable. He's targeting immigrants. He's targeting dissidents. He's targeting transgender folks. He's targeting people of color, but he's also seeking to neutralize any place where there might be opposition, the checks and balances. So removing heads of agencies, removing inspectors general, targeting the press and punishing them if they disagree, targeting law firms and punishing them if they disagree, and now also targeting universities and punishing them in totally unlawful ways. So universities under our Constitution are protected by the First Amendment. They have heightened what the court has called a special concern of the First Amendment is academic freedom, precisely because universities need to be places of free exchange, free inquiry. The court has said the First Amendment precludes political officials from interfering in the management of their academic affairs, in what they teach, who teaches it, what rules they apply vis-a-vis their students' speech and their professor's speech and the like. It's the university's freedom to make those decisions. Trump doesn't like how they've made those decisions. Again, principally on the issue of Israel, but I think that's being used basically as an excuse. What he's really trying to do is hem in any check or any criticism or any opposition from universities across this country by holding over their heads the millions and in some instances billions of dollars of federal funding that supports research that these universities carry out for us, you know, life-saving research. And he's doing it by asserting that the universities have in one way or another violated Title VI, which requires that recipients of federal funding not discriminate on the basis of race or national identity in their programs. And he claims, well, you know, they're tolerating anti-Semitism, therefore they're violating Title VI, therefore I'm going to punish them. Well, that's not how the law works. The law says that if the federal government wants to withhold funds because it claims that a university has violated Title VI, it has to specify the specific violation. It has to provide notice of that specific violation, a specific incident in which, you know, there was anti-Semitism and the school failed to respond adequately. It then has to give the university an opportunity to respond. It then has to engage in a program-by-program evaluation and can only withdraw funds to the extent that they are related to the particular program that constituted the violation. Has the Trump administration done any of that? No. It has not identified a single instance of anti-Semitism by students at Columbia, at Cornell, at Northwestern, at Princeton, at any of these schools where it has frozen funds. It has not identified a single instance of anti-Semitism that the schools failed to respond to adequately. Instead, it just waves its arms and says, anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism, without identifying a specific instance. And that is really problematic, because the line between free speech and anti-Semitic harassment is a difficult one to draw. If somebody gets up on campus and says, you know, from the river to the sea, that's their First Amendment right. If two people do it, that's their First Amendment right. If three people do it, that's their First Amendment right. I could go out on the street corner right now and say, from the river to the sea, and the government could not punish me for it because it's my First Amendment right. If enough students are saying that, and directing it at Jewish students so that Jewish students feel they don't have equal access to the educational environment, well, then a Title VI problem may arise and the school may need to respond in a particular way. But drawing that line is very difficult. Very few courts have found that this kind of speech constitutes, even conceivably, constitutes a Title VI violation. And so you need to have facts and circumstances to see whether the schools were simply allowing students to speak freely, which is their right, or failing to respond to actual discrimination, which they, are required to do. The Trump administration has just blown past that and instead is threatening to withhold billions of dollars from these universities if they don't do the Trump administration's bidding. And then, as you indicate, the Trump administration's bidding includes things like, oh, I don't like the head of this department, replace him. Or a report suggests, I don't like the Columbia University president, so replace her. And Columbia did replace her. Well, the president of the United States should not be deciding who is the head of a private university's academic department or of the university itself. Those are First Amendment academic freedom decisions of universities. But what Trump is seeking to do here is to neutralize the opposition. This is what autocrats do in many other countries. When they come to power, they look for where the opposition might come. The press, the lawyers, the universities, the nonprofit sector, that will be next, and they seek to neutralize opposition. That's Trump's plan here, and it's clear as day.
You're at Georgetown, David Cole. We want to ask you about the new video that's emerged on the arrest of Badr Khansouri, the Georgetown University prof and postdoctoral scholar who last month was ambushed by masked federal agents outside his family's home in Rosslyn, Virginia, after repeatedly being transferred across five ICE facilities, currently jailed at an ICE detention center in Texas. His legal team saying that for 2 weeks he was placed in a cell without a bed, a television blaring 21 hours a day, was denied food or water to break his Ramadan fast. So I wanted to ask you about him, about Rumeysa Öztürk in Tufts, about Mahmoud Khalil, all of these takings of these students, these scholars, these professors, and with Badr Khansouri at your university.
Yeah, so Professor Badr Khansouri was teaching in the Center for Christian Muslim Understanding. The Center for Christian Muslim Understanding, that's where he was teaching. He was teaching a class that violates no law whatsoever. And yet he comes out of class goes home to his wife and child, and outside of his home is picked up by masked federal agents. And as you suggest, spirited off across many states and many detention centers. And what's the charge against him? As far as we can tell, the charge is his presence here threatens serious foreign policy consequences. Why? Because he has said some things on social media that support the rights of Palestinians against the Israeli attack on Gaza. And because he is married to the daughter of somebody who used to be in Hamas. Married to the daughter, a U.S. citizen daughter, of somebody who used to be in Hamas. This is guilt by association. No charge that he engaged in any criminal conduct. No charge that he advocated any kind of illegal conduct. No charge that he provided support to terrorist activity. Simply that he said some things we don't like, and he's married to someone who is in turn related to someone who used to be in Hamas. That is, again, an outrageous action by the government, because you have a right to say things about the way people in Gaza are being treated. You say so every day on this show, and you can't be punished for doing so under our First Amendment. So Professor Khansouri cannot be punished for doing so. And you have a right to marry who you want, regardless of who their parent is. That is not a basis for kicking you out of this country. And yet he's been torn from his child, torn from his wife, simply for what he stands for in terms of his political views. And the same thing with the woman at Tufts. As far as we can tell, her only offense, if you want to call it an offense, is having written an op-ed in the Tufts school newspaper criticizing the Tufts administration for not being hard enough in its stance against atrocities in Gaza. Again, we all have a First Amendment right to criticize atrocities in Gaza and criticize others who are not criticizing those atrocities as they deserve to be criticized. That is our First Amendment protection. And yet she was, like Mr. Khansouri, picked up by masked agents and spirited away simply for what she said. And the same thing with Mahmoud Khalil, the graduate student, a green card holder at Columbia. What is his offense? Didn't engage in any criminal activity. He didn't support some terrorist activity. He simply spoke out during the protests about the horrific human rights abuses. Yeah. So these are core First Amendment activities, and foreign nationals should not be targeted for those activities. Universities should not be targeted for those activities. We should celebrate that we're a strong enough country that we can have dissent protected by the First Amendment and not punished by the Trump administration.
David Cole, I want to thank you so much for being with us. He is the Honorable George J. Mitchell Professor in Law and Public Policy at the Georgetown University Law Center, former National Legal Director of the ACLU. We'll link to your articles. And as we broadcast from Ball State in Muncie, there are students that are standing outside the studio holding signs that say Ball State arrested five peaceful protesters and no, the Ball State five arrested for speaking out. The hearing for the Ball State Five will take place in court on April 23rd. They were charged with disorderly conduct as they took on a Board of Trustees meeting, and they were charged with disorderly conduct. According to the statement that was given by the university to the Ball State Daily News, one was charged with disorderly conduct with unreasonable noise. Coming up, Trump requests a $1 trillion budget for the Pentagon while other agencies face major cuts or even elimination. Back in 20 seconds.
It's been a long time since we laughed until we cried. It's been a short time in the entirety of life. Between the veil, make some sounds that no one wants to hear. Humanity, what have we done to this? Is there nothing left?
Gloom Absolutely. Designs by Florist. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Muncie, Indiana at Ball State, and Juan Gonzalez is in Chicago. While many federal agencies are facing crippling cuts and being forced to cut essential services, President Trump has announced he would seek a $1 trillion budget for the Pentagon. He made the comment while speaking to reporters alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
We also essentially approved a budget which is in the facility, you'll like to hear this, of $1 trillion, and nobody's seen anything like it. We have to build our military, and we're very cost conscious, but the military is something that we have to build.
We're joined now by William Hartung, senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His new piece for Forbes is headlined, Does America Really Need a $1 Trillion Pentagon Budget? He's also co-author of the forthcoming book, The Trillion Dollar War Machine, which will be out later this year. So, Bill Hartung, answer your own question. Does the Pentagon really need a $1 trillion budget? Talk about what's going on here as DOGE, as the Trump administration, slices and dices and removes and eliminates other agencies.
Do we need a trillion is kind of a softball question because the answer is absolutely no. We're already spending too much. And this really gives the lie to the idea that it's about efficiency. They've almost eliminated the Agency for National Development, eliminated private education, cutting the Center for Disease Control, going after Medicaid, cutting staff at the Social Security Administration. If they're about efficiency, first of all, they couldn't do it overnight. They'd have to study what works and what doesn't. So basically, they're decimating our civilian government, which provides needed services here and abroad, and they're rewarding Pentagon contractors, including Elon Musk, who's got unprecedented power. You know, the Silicon Valley militarists don't even need to lobby this administration because they're embedded within it. J.D. Vance was groomed by Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley military person. You've got Musk. You've got people spread throughout these different agencies. There was some hope because of Trump's rhetoric. He said, well, if we can, you know, warm up to China and Russia, we could cut military budget in half. Nuclear weapons cost too much. I was pretty sure that was just a kind of a bone to those in his base, some of whom are sick of endless wars, don't trust these corporations. But I didn't expect him to really go along with it. And indeed, he has. And he's talking about building a golden dome, which is sort of akin to Reagan's impenetrable Star Wars missile shield, which almost all scientists say is not possible to do. So that's a big boondoggle for both the old companies like Lockheed Martin and the new companies like Anduril and Palantir. And then, of course, this new fighter plane, which he decided to call the F-47 because he's the 47th president. I mean, might as well put his name on the side. There's no indication this is going to work. Andrew Coburn, a longstanding analyst, has written a piece about this. So at the same time, they're saying, you know, they're going to preserve every penny, spend it wisely. They're putting money at these new boondoggles. Of course, they've never passed an audit. They paid dramatically more than they should for spare parts. They've gotten rid of independent inspectors general who could follow whether there's corruption going on. So this is really an effort to militarize our society. What Eisenhower warned about, that we didn't want America to become a garrison state. And getting rid of AID, you know, America's face to the world now is going to be almost entirely military. You know, AID had its problems, but also provided clean water, food, aid, you know, HIV prevention services that help millions of people around the world. So I think this really is bad for America's influence in the world. It's bad for large numbers of people. almost the only beneficiaries are going to be the weapons contractors. And, of course, this is going to be the highest Pentagon budget since World War II, so higher than peak of Korean Vietnam, higher than the peak of the Afghan and Iraq wars. And it's completely unnecessary, and it's actually going to make us less safe.
And, Bill, you've written other articles questioning even whether the official Defense Department budget is actually much larger, possibly twice as large, the military budget of the United States. Could you talk about this discrepancy between the official budget and the actual expenditures of the U.S.?
Yes. Well, it's not just the Pentagon budget that has a military purpose or is the result of militarized foreign policy. Nuclear warheads are done in the Department of Energy. Some of our military aid is in the international affairs budget instead of the Pentagon budget. Of course, the Veterans Administration has mushroomed to take care of the Iraq and Afghan vets, of whom hundreds of thousands have physical wounds, PTSD, and so forth. And then, part of our interest on the debt is attributable to our huge military expenditures. And that interest is soon going to be higher than almost any other government agency. So whether you're concerned about fiscal responsibility or basic services, this is just not the way to go. And the rationale for it is this kind of cover the globe strategy that we need 750 military bases, 11 aircraft carriers, essentially floating air bases, more nuclear weapons. We need a different strategy. This idea of getting tough and peace through strength has been a disaster in this century. If you look at the outcomes of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which were supposed to be won through superior technology, but then because the opposition knew the local terrain, local culture, come up with cheap countermeasures like improvised explosives devices. All the technology in the world was not going to win those wars. So the idea that we're going to take the same approach against a large, powerful country like China could be a recipe for disaster. And the lead kind of arguments in that front are coming from Silicon Valley militarists like Peter Thiel, Palmer Luckey, and so forth.
Bill, I wanted to ask you about that particularly. You recently wrote for a monthly review, a review of a book by Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir, and you say in there about these Silicon Valley militarists, you say all of them are convinced that at some future moment, by supplanting the old school corporate weapon makers like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman, they will usher in a golden age of American global primacy grounded in ever better technology. You talk about this rise of the Silicon Valley militarists.
Sure. I originally wrote that for Tom Dispatch, which allows people to write this kind of thing, which is not easy to do anymore. But Karp has a book, and it's essentially kind of like, 19th century ideology with 21st century technology. He says America's lost its way. We don't believe in the concept of the West. We're not patriotic, and we need a unifying national mission. His idea of that mission is a new Manhattan Project to militarize artificial intelligence. To me, that's a pretty impoverished view of what our mission should be as a nation. Our mission is supposed to be tolerance, democracy, prosperity, diversity, all the things that are under attack at the moment. So this is completely backwards. And the thing is, Palantir, for example, was one of the few companies to actually cheerlead the war in Gaza. Some of their technology was used for targeting. Karp decided to actually have their board meeting in Israel during the Gaza war. And they also are, once we master AI, we'll be able to beat China in a war and so forth. So they're a different breed. The head of Lockheed Martin, he'll fund think tanks that make, sympathetic case. But he's not, with a bullhorn saying, let's dominate the world, because he feels like that's a bad look for somebody who's, profiting from this. Whereas these Silicon Valley folks are shameless. They really think that they're our saviors, and that they can do things better than the government. And they've got some wild ideas, like Peter Thiel is researching how to live forever, and Elon Musk wants mass colonization of space, and Palmer Luckey is basically a gamer who decided to make weapons. These are not the people you want shaping your foreign policy. I mean, if they had a product that was worth, for defense, buy the product. They should be vendors. They shouldn't be trying to shape our policy, our worldview, our government, and they shouldn't be allowed to do that.
Bill Hartung, if you can talk more about Elon Musk and his conflicts of interest as he goes after these other agencies. It's not just that they're increasing, and Hegseth has announced this $1 trillion Pentagon budget. It's that Elon Musk has multi-million dollar contracts with the Pentagon. If you could discuss that, and then also the Pentagon repeatedly citing China as its principal adversary. Now there's a trade war looming. How do you see this playing out?
Well, Musk has more power than the entire cabinet combined. He's almost co-president, and he owns a country, SpaceX, that is going to make a version of Starlink for the military, launches a lot of our military satellites, has a new product called the Starship that supposedly will be able to put more payload in space than any other weapon. And the Pentagon looks to this as a way to, you know, beat China in the space race. So his Pentagon contracts are only going to grow. And he may well try to shift money towards his Silicon Valley allies. He's trashed the F-35, which is reasonable, but he said, let's replace it with unpiloted, you know, drones. So it's kind of an unprecedented situation to kind of anoint, an unelected billionaire to have this kind of power. And especially since the Pentagon has a very obvious conflict of interest. I've never seen anything like this. I mean, these folks were vetting people during the transition of who could work at the Pentagon. And of course, Musk, they sort of made this sound like this was advisory, but they're actually basically dismantling government, laying off scientists and experts who we need for things like fighting pandemics. He's a walking
conflict
of interest.
Just to be really clear, I want to correct myself. I said millions of dollars. U.S. Space Force announced Friday it would award SpaceX contracts. SpaceX is Elon Musk's company, privately held company. It would award SpaceX contracts worth approximately $5.9 billion, $6 billion.
Yes, and it'll only grow in the future. In fact, Bloomberg has said this is kind of the weapons contractor of the years to come. Whether they can, outplay Lockheed Martin that gets $40 or $50 billion a year is yet to be seen. But there's going to be a battle. You know, Silicon Valley is embedded in the executive branch. Lockheed Martin has huge influence in Congress because they put facilities in most of the states. They hire former government officials to lobby for them. They fund think tanks. They serve on government commissions that make policy. So this is either a clash of the titans or, as often happens, they'll just push the budget high enough to fund both of them.
We just have 30 seconds. If you could respond on China.
Yes. Well, China is the gift that keeps on giving. Exaggerating the threat from China is a way to fund these companies. I mean, it's basically Washington State, China. You know, that's another $1 billion for a weapons contract. In fact, we should have an accommodation with China, not be preparing for a war with China.
We're going to leave it there. And I want to thank you so much for joining us, Bill Hartung, senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll link to your piece at Forbes. Does America really need a $1 trillion Pentagon budget? Special thanks to our local production crew here at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. I want to thank Elvin Cesario, Ben Caldwell, and Tegan Chandler. And special thanks to Corey Olenkamp, to Dean Kristen McAuliffe, and to Kim McClure, as well as Dennis Moynihan. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Werner, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamer Riasti, Joe John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Masood, Anjali Kamat, Safwat Nazal. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago and here in Muncie, Indiana.
Listen to Scream Therapy, a show about the link between punk rock and mental health, hosted by me, Jason Schurz. I've been part of the music scene for more than 30 years. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and my whole life was thrown sideways. As part of my recovery, I've slowly returned to the music that I love. Join me and my resilient guests for no-holds-barred conversations right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University, Thursdays at 12:30 a.m. And until then, take care and be well.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Burnaby, the Chablis.